You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Welcome to Before They Were Live, an ongoing, monthly, and extremely nerdy conversation through the land of fairy, or the perilous realm. In his seminal essay on fairy stories, J.R.R. Tolkien says he has hardly been more than a wandering explorer or trespasser in the land, full of wonder, but not of information. We take the same tack. We are, as ever, interested in playing our part in a healthy ecosystem of art, criticism, and fandom, paid attention to the ways stories have shaped our collective imaginations. We are slurpers of soup, happy to ladle out a bowlful from the great cauldron of story that has been bubbling and brewing for centuries. W.H. Auden said, "Art is our chief means of breaking bread with the dead." So pull up a chair to our table, grab yourself a soup bowl and a big old chunk of homemade bread, help us enrich this reading experience, and have some fun too. We've got 10 more Brothers Grimm stories for you today. A few may be familiar, a few may not be. We'll retell them here if you haven't read them. Joining me as always to tell these stories is the two-eyed Michael Farmer, who got all of his wisdom from hanging head down from a sack in a tree. And that will all make sense later.
So, four eyes, to be fair, Josh.
Four eyes, that's right. Yeah, four eyes. Yeah, you and I both are four eyes. So
that's true, yeah. So we want to apologize in advance to our listeners. It sounds like both of us are sick or just getting over an illness. Also, it's a Tuesday night when we're recording, so we usually record on the weekends. I don't know. I think both of us feel a little underprepared, so I just want to set everybody's expectations lower than normal.
That's right. We're just here to have fun and have drippy noses while we do it.
That's right. So if your expectations were once a 747, I think now they should be a crop duster.
There you go.
Just skim it across the top of that corn.
All right. Well, our first story, Michael, is one you chose. It is The Iron Stove, and it's number 127 in our numbering. We're reading the Jack Zipes translation. I don't know if it's the same in all the.
I think that's standard numbering, because if you go to the Wikipedia page for the Brothers Grimm, those are the numbers there. So I don't think that's Zipes' numbering. I think that's what folklorists have agreed is going to be the numbering.
All right. Great.
So, in The Iron Stove, a witch turns a prince into a stove, basically. She doesn't actually turn him into the stove. She makes him sit in the stove and locks him in a cabin in the forest. And one day, a princess gets lost in the forest and stumbles across the stove. And the Iron Stove with the prince inside tells her if she does what he tells her to do, he will marry her. And of course, she's flipped out by this because she doesn't realize that he's a prince inside the stove, and she thinks it's just an anthropomorphic stove talking to her. So she tries to get two other women from her kingdom to come back, and she has to scrape a hole in the iron stove to rescue the prince inside. So first she tries to get the miller's daughter to do it, and the miller's daughter gives herself away by saying that she hears the clattering of her father's mill, and then she sends the swineherd's daughter, and she gives herself away by saying that she hears the horn of her father, so he knows that she's the swineherd's daughter. And so finally he says, if you don't send the real princess, when I get out of the stove, I'm going to destroy the entire kingdom. And so finally the real princess comes and does what she's supposed to do and sets the prince free, and they're about to live happily ever after. Except that she wants to go see her father before she runs away and marries the prince. And so the prince says, sure, but you're only allowed to say three words to your father. And she agrees, but then she goes back and says more than three words, and the iron stove goes a long way away. The prince is no longer in it, but the stove itself is gone. So she goes back to the forest to try to find the prince, and she doesn't find him because the stove and he are both gone. And instead, she finds an enchanted cabin with a lot of toads sitting around a very nicely covered table with wine and a roast and all sorts of other good things, silver cups and what have you. They welcome her. She tells the story, and they tell her what she needs to do, which is she needs to get over a glass mountain, three sharp swords, and a great lake. And she goes on the quest to do this. But meanwhile, the prince has found another woman who he wants to marry because he assumes that the princess is already dead. Nevertheless, she ends up at his castle. He doesn't recognize her. She works as a servant girl. And then she has to sleep in his room. Then she gives him a glass of wine with a sleeping potion. I'm sorry, the bride gives him a glass of wine with a sleeping potion, and so she can't wake him up, and she's very sad about this. But eventually the other servants in the castle tell him what has happened, and he recognizes her as his true bride, and they live happily ever after. This is another one of those stories that has like 15 pieces to it, and so I lost track of it there for a second. I'm sorry about that.
No, I think you did a very nice job retelling that, because it's a little wild. It's even for these stories, it's a little wild.
So many of them are titled after something that disappears after the first three paragraphs. Like the iron stove plays no role in this. After he's set free from the iron stove, which happens before all the questing, before the magical toads, before the sleeping draft and the false bride. It's just weird. I wonder how the Grimms decided what they were what title they were going to give, because I'm sure that it's not like these came to them with titles.
Right.
Right. Like, I'm sure that they're hearing them in the oral tradition. And so probably it's just a story. And I mean, maybe that's the element in the story that doesn't appear in any others, because there's certainly a glass mountain in other stories. There's talking toads in other stories. There's true brides and false brides in other stories. It's just weird that the iron stove, this thing that's a relatively minor element at the beginning, ends up being the title.
Yeah, I think you're right, though. I think you hit on something there, because there's so many repeated elements in these stories, which is part of what makes them fun to read, but to see how things get mashed together or smashed together from different places, you know. But yeah, you can imagine sitting around the campfire or whatever and be like, tell us that one about the stove.
You know? Right. I guess that's true. Like if you were talking to someone who had memorized all 200 or whatever of these stories, I suppose that is the thing you would use to distinguish it, because I'm not familiar with another one that has an iron stove in it. Are you?
No, but like I said, so many of these things blur together, because I mean, you just mentioned that it's not the only one with a glass mountain, but I'm trying to remember which other one has a glass mountain.
I don't remember the name of it, but there's one where a guy has to scale a glass mountain.
Yeah.
It might be in the section we haven't even talked about yet. I don't remember.
Yeah, that's possible.
It's funny. Like, these were clearly not meant to just be sat down and read through.
Yeah. Although, what I would say about that is that there is, like, common thematic elements that show up in different sections. Like, I think we've talked about that in the past. Like, in this section that we read for this time, there's a lot of these themes of princes or suitors or whatever being in disguise of some kind.
Sure.
And then being discovered, you know, or there's like a misjudging of them because of the disguise, and then they're seen. So
it is just fundamental to fairy tales that they deal with the difference between appearance and reality.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part of them, and that's the part that, like, you know, bothers me a little bit on our read-throughs, is that I just always feel like the weirdness is trying to point me to reality, and, you know, and not just appearance, but like, I can't always get there. So then I'm like, man, I'm really missing out on reality.
Right. Yeah. It is. It's just difficult to see what it's pointing to, besides the fact that things aren't always the way they seem.
Yeah.
And we've talked about how hard it is to draw any kind of clear moral from a lot of these. Like, there, I know I've expressed this before, but the idea that these stories are primarily here to teach children moral lessons, it's the lie is put to that basically as soon as you read them. There are some where that's clearly true, and next time we're going to read some religious tales for children, and definitely some of those have very clear little moral lessons. But a lot of these are so anarchic and so strange that it's just difficult to imagine that anybody is using them to teach simple lessons to children.
Right. But I think that's the key there, is it's like, it's not teaching simple lessons, but there is something to be gained from that. Like, I think the appearances versus reality thing is really important. And it's not just like, you know, if it was just, oh, things aren't always what they seem, well, that's a simple lesson, right?
Right, right.
But like, on a deeper level, there is like this sense of like, there's some sort of, I don't know, cosmic truth or something like buried in these stories, you know, and but it is sometimes hard to figure out where that's at, especially, you know, we view the world so much differently than the people who are originally telling these stories did, that I think it's hard for us to grasp it sometimes.
Right. And maybe it's just a matter of order being restored at the end of most of these stories, that he recognizes his true bride, whatever that means.
Yeah.
When he sees her. I mean, it's not like they were fated to be together at the beginning of the story, but somehow when he sees her, he knows that she's his true bride. I mean, maybe that's just things being set right. And I mean, maybe that's as far as the kind of cosmic significance goes.
Right. Yeah, could be.
And I mean, to me, still the best of these that we've read has been King Thrushbeard. And that one, I think, takes a lot of that motion and makes it explicitly, or maybe just super implicitly, religious. And I find that story to be extraordinarily moving in a way that a lot of these I don't. Like, you know, they're funny sometimes, they're cute. Very rarely am I moved by them, but King Thrushbeard makes sense to me. Like, it hits me on a kind of soul level in a way that a lot of these don't.
Right.
Even the ones I pick.
No, I agree with you. Yeah. I did like this one, though. Like, the cottage full of toads is so, I don't know, it's so fun. And I guess I have a thing for talking toads, maybe, but I think they're cool. So, yeah.
Is but it just like your Wind in the Willows hangover, Josh?
I guess it's Wind in the Willows. Yeah, maybe that's what it is.
Frog and Toad. You must have read Frog and Toad when you were growing up.
Frog and Toad, Wind in the Willows, both of those. And then, you know, the Bruce Coville's like a children's writer. Like, you might have read him when you were a kid. He wrote My Teacher's an Alien, that series. Did you read that?
Oh, I loved those.
Yeah, they're so fun, right? But he's got another series, and it's outside of my memory right now. I can't bring it to mind, but there's talking toads in that one. So whatever that other series is, somebody can Wikipedia it later and tell me. So anyway, one part that you left out in your retelling is that, so she receives from the toads, she receives these three nuts, and then each night she like bites into the nut and a beautiful dress comes out. And then she wants the bride, the false bride, wants the dress, and she won't give it to her unless she lets her go into the room with the groom and stay there overnight with him, which is kind of a weird ask, right?
Yeah. Well, to be fair, these fairy tales are full of weird asks.
Yeah. But the princess wants the dress so bad that she lets her do it, you know. But yeah, what a weird, like, I don't know. I think that's a lovely image, though. The beautiful dress is coming out of the nuts. Like, I don't know. There's something about the seeds of things, you know, growing into something.
They contain more than they could possibly contain.
Yeah, I don't know. I liked it. So, but what a weird, bizarre curse that this prince is under, because he's, first of all, he's in the and I don't want to draw this out too long because I know we've got 10 to get through, but like, he's, first of all, it's the iron stove, which we already mentioned, like that's a weird thing, like he gets locked in a stove. And then
can you imagine how bad his leg cramp must have been to get out of the iron stove?
Right. And then he gets whisked away. It's not clear whose kingdom he's in after he's whisked away over the glass mountain and the swords and all that, right? And he thinks that his bride must be dead, so he falls in love with this other girl. And we've read other stories where when he falls in love with the false bride, it's like part of the curse. It's not explicit in this one that it's part of the curse, so I'm not sure exactly what's going on there. Like, because he's got a kingdom of frogs, you know, that he's not like working to get back to or anything. I mean, he does end up with them once the curse is broken, but it's just very weird. It's a very strange curse this guy's under.
Well, shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah, let's talk about One Eye, Two Eyes, Three Eyes. What a great title.
Comparatively straightforward fairy tale, to be fair.
Sure.
So there's a woman who has three daughters, and she gives them all very appropriate names. One Eye has one eye right in the middle of her forehead. Two Eyes has two eyes, like you and me when we're not wearing glasses. And Three Eyes has three eyes, which means she has two eyes and then an extra one right in the middle of her forehead. But everybody hates Two Eyes because she looks like everybody else. So they think she's common, and so they pick on her, and they don't give her enough food to eat, and they just treat her very poorly. So Two Eyes' job is to go out into the fields and tend to the goat. And she's out there one day crying, and a wise woman comes up to her and teaches her that if she says this little rhyme to the goat, little goat, bleat and bring me things to eat, she'll get as much food as she likes. And then she can say, little goat, bleat, I've had enough to eat, and the food will disappear. So she starts doing this, and One Eye and Three Eyes start to realize that she's not eating the food that they're eating. And so they wonder what's up. And so they decide that One Eye is going to go with her and make sure she's not up to something, which of course she is. But then Two Eyes sings this song that puts her to sleep. And so she can call the goat to bring her food, and One Eye will never know. Well, the next day, Three Eyes decides to go, and she tries to sing the song to put Three Eyes to sleep, but she forgets about that third eye. So she puts two of her eyes to sleep, but the third one stays awake and sees everything. And so she knows what's going on with the goat, and the mother, when she finds out, kills the goat so that, I don't know, to punish Two Eyes for not wanting to starve to death. I'm not exactly sure what her motivation is other than just pure envy and evil. Well, the wise woman shows up again, and this time she says, if you will take the entrails of the goat and bury it in front of the house, something good will happen. And so she does, and this beautiful golden and silver tree grows, and there's lots of delicious looking fruit on it, except that One Eye and Three Eyes can't ever pick a single apple off the tree because it'll only yield itself over to Two Eyes. And then one day, a handsome young knight rides by and says that anybody who will give him some of the apples or the branches from the tree will get anything he wants, they want from him. And of course, One Eye and Three Eyes can't do it, even though they insist that the tree belongs to them. And finally, Two Eyes, who has been shoved into a barrel to keep her from talking to the knight, comes out and is able to do that, and they get married. And, you know, weirdly, for one of these evil stepsisters stories, things end up pretty good for One Eye and Three Eyes as well. At first they're poor and have to beg around the kingdom, but eventually they are invited to come live with Two Eyes and her husband, and everybody, and I mean everybody, lives happily ever after.
Yeah, I like that ending. You're right, it's surprising, but there's a nice little reconciliation at the end. They're sorry for their evil ways, you know, they repent and there's forgiveness. Kind of a Joseph going down to Egypt type thing. You know?
That is exactly what I thought. Yeah, they're won over by hospitality. And you know, the thing is, when she first gets served by the goat, she says the shortest prayer she knew: "Lord God, be our guest at all times." So, somehow, like, that gets echoed here at the end, where not God, but her evil sisters are her guests.
Yeah, that's really, I missed that connection, but that's really good, Michael.
This is like really one of the few fairy tales where someone is abused and responds. There's no punishment. There's forgiveness instead of a punishment. It's not the only one, but it is. It's one of the few.
Yeah,
that's what I liked about it. It seems almost like a rewriting of the Cinderella story.
Yes, it's very Cinderella-y. Yeah, very Cinderella-y.
And they hate her because she's normal, which is interesting. It reminds
me of
that Twilight Zone episode, Eye of the Beholder. Have you seen that?
No.
Well, I'm about to spoil an episode of the Twilight Zone. So okay. Anybody who doesn't want to know, Josh, maybe you should take your headphones off for a minute.
Okay.
In Eye of the Beholder, it's a very long, very slow episode. So for 25 minutes, they're talking about this hideously ugly woman who has had a facial reconstruction surgery, and this is like her fifth or sixth surgery or something.
Oh, I do know this one, but continue. Yes, I do know this one.
Over the course of the whole episode, they're taking the bandages off and just praying that the surgery will work. And they finish taking the bandage off, and it turns out, oh no, the surgery didn't work. And it cuts to the woman, and she's like remarkably beautiful. And then it cuts to the people, and they all have pig faces because, of course, like, you know, it's, you know, it's your society that determines what superficial beauty really looks like.
Yeah. Yeah. Which it begs the question, how many eyes do you think that knight had?
The other thing I liked about this is one of the reasons One Eye falls asleep, other than the song she's singing, is that she's unaccustomed from the walk and the heat of the sun. Yeah. So like Two Eyes' superpower is that she has to work with her hands out in the sun. And so she has a kind of stamina that her two sisters, who have always gotten everything they wanted, don't have. So you do get that kind of diligence as a virtue motif.
Oh, yeah.
Which you get in Cinderella, too, and several other stories like this. Can you imagine if they had made this into a Disney movie instead of Cinderella?
could have been really cool. I think the image of the tree, like withdrawing the apples from the sisters as they try to get it. That's very, I could see that in a Disney cartoon.
And it's not just that it withdraws from the sisters. When Two Eyes takes an apple, it just drops into her hand. She's not actually doing anything.
Right.
It's an image of grace, right? It's just given to her.
It's like you said, it's pretty straightforward. I was wondering, is that our first fairy godmother? I can't remember. I know there have been other kind old women that we've like met in the forest.
Is she explicitly
like
called a fairy godmother?
She's not, but she sure acts like one. And
I almost called her that.
Yeah, and I think the difference from my memory, I don't remember all of these that we've read, you know, but the difference is I feel like normally, like, you might find a friendly old woman, like on your quest, like when you're in the forest, or, I mean, even the devil's grandmother was kind of kind in some ways, you know, but this one appears to her, you know, shows up. So that's what struck me as slightly different.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. It that is definitely the motif, is the fairy godmother.
Yeah. So yeah, I wrote down in my notes too, you mentioned in the story, like why she killed the goat. This is like, you know, it's very similar to like the table set, you know, from the you know, that story. I can't remember what the name of it is. You've got an eternal feast, you know, like what.
yeah. But I think that might be part of the point, right? That this woman is so given over to envy and wrath that she can't even, it's not in her benefit to do this, and yet she does it. She almost can't help herself.
Right. Yeah.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Think about how self-sabotaging you are at your worst.
Yes. Yeah. It does make sense with the villainy of it. And I think also with that theme that you pulled out that I missed of the hospitality, like it's like anti-hospitality, you know? We would rather all starve than invite you to our table. So
yeah, and it's not even like the girl was like, you're not going to get any of the food. You know, it's not like she was trying to keep the goat to herself. The only reason she didn't tell them is because she knew that something like this would happen.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it really is a surprise at the end of the story when, instead of them being put into a pointed barrel and rolled down the side of a mountain or whatever, they're welcomed into her house and they're won over by her kindness, which, you know, what a good thing to see.
Absolutely. All right. Well, our next one is the worn out dancing shoes. So once upon a time, there was a king. He has 12 beautiful daughters, and each one is more beautiful than the last. And all these daughters sleep together in the same large room. All the beds are side by side. And every evening, the king would lock them in the room. And then every morning, he would find that their dancing shoes were all worn out. And the king does not like this at all. So he makes a proclamation that anyone who could solve the mystery of where his daughters are dancing each evening could marry one of his daughters and also become king after his death. So the caveat, though, it's a pretty big caveat, is that if you don't solve the mystery in 3 nights, then it's off with your head. So many princes lose their heads trying to solve this mystery. But along comes this old soldier, and he meets an old woman who... And he just kind of jokingly mentions to her that he wishes he could solve this mystery. And she says, oh, it's really not that big a deal. You just don't need to drink wine before bed, and then you'll stay awake and be able to follow the princesses and find out what's happening. And she also gives him a magical invisibility cloak so that he can follow along. So he goes, presents himself to the king, gets himself a bed in the antechamber of their room with an open door there so he can see. In the evening, the oldest daughter brings him some wine, but he has a hidden sponge under his chin, very clever, and he's able to pretend to drink the wine. And then he pretends to go to sleep, and he's snoring over there. And the princesses, they're like, oh, he, you know, probably had a good life ahead of him, but now his head's going to be chopped off just like the rest of them. But they're not really that worried about it. They dress in these splendid dresses, and they tap on the oldest daughter's bed, and it sinks into the floor. It's very magical and mysterious, and there's some stairs there, and they all go down the stairs. The soldier quickly jumps up and follows behind in his invisible cloak. He accidentally steps on the youngest princess's dress, and she calls out, but her eldest sister just scolds her and says, you know, your dress got hooked on something. You're worrying too much. So they get to the bottom of these steps, and there's this avenue of silver trees. And the soldier thinks, I've got to have evidence. So he breaks off a branch, and it's loud. It's a loud snap. The youngest hears it. She's worried that they're going to be found out this time. But the oldest ignores her warning, says, it's just somebody, you know, one of us 12 just shouted for joy because we're about to see our princes. And so then they go down 2 more avenues of trees. There's an avenue of gold trees and then an avenue of diamond trees. And the same thing happens. The soldier breaks the branches. The youngest sister is worried. The oldest sister is not worried. They come to a large lake, and in the lake there are 12 boats, and each boat there's a prince, and they all board the boats with their respective princes, and they sail off to a beautiful bright palace on the other side of the lake, and they dance there until 3 o'clock in the morning. And then they return, and as they are returning, the soldier gets ahead of them and races back up so that he's in bed when they all return. So they come back, they don't suspect anything. For some reason, not clear why, the soldier lets this go on for 2 more nights. He goes and follows them again 2 more nights. And then on the 3rd morning, when the king calls him in to find out if he knows what's happened, he reveals everything. He has the branches from the trees to prove that he was there. And the princesses are called in by the king, and they confess everything. And then the soldier chooses the eldest princess as his bride. And then the dancing princes are compelled to remain under a curse for as many nights as they had danced with the princes. So it's not exactly happily ever after, but I guess they're all free from the spell of going down, I guess. I don't know. It's unclear to me if this is a spell or not, that they go.
Right, or if they're enjoying themselves going and dancing all night.
Yeah, it seems like the oldest one at least is enjoying herself. But it did
just want to have fun.
Yeah, that's right. It did give me a Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell kind of vibe.
Have you I never that read book? That book.
Oh, it's a good one. And in it, there is a... There's a lot that happens in that book, but one of the things that happens in that book is there's a curse or a spell put on somebody, and they're forced to go to this ball every night and dance all night, and then, you know, awaken in the morning and not really like, it was it a dream, was it not a dream, but it's like every night that they're going to this ball. So it kind of reminded me of that. It's a good book. I recommend it.
I've heard it's good.
So I couldn't tell if the eldest princess, because she's kind of the, like, I don't know.
She's the only one who really has a personality.
Yeah. She marries the prince, or marries the soldier, which, you know, in a lot of these stories, it's not good to marry down. And she has a prince in this magical castle below. So I couldn't tell if she was being, like, punished because she didn't listen to her younger sister, or if it's just the way the story goes. I don't know. I couldn't tell.
Well, and she's pretty cruel, right? When he pretends to fall asleep, they make fun of him. And yeah. She says he could have done better things with his life too.
Right.
Like, yeah, that's a very callous thing to say about somebody who's about to get killed because you drugged them.
Right. Certainly she's not the one I would have picked. Just reading through the story, I mean, we don't know a lot about any of them. Like you said, only the oldest really has a personality, but it's not a great personality. I feel like, you know, one of the other 11 might have been okay.
Well, and he picks her because he's not so young himself, which I liked. Yeah. But you imagine he kind of likes the cut of her jib. He kind of likes that she's a little mean.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah.
I do think it's important that he's not a prince, that the princes have failed, and that this old soldier who doesn't have anything else to do with his life, he's the one who actually manages to solve the mystery.
Ah, yeah. What do you think that means?
I don't know that it means anything, but it is. I mean, you mentioned the number of these stories where people married down. And I like this is I think that is important.
Yeah, there does seem to be, and we've talked about this before on some of the episodes, that the upsetting of the whole class system, if you want to call it that, you know, status and wealth and all that stuff seems to play into a lot of these stories. And I don't know if that's like I don't know if anybody knows, you know, if it's something that was like added in because of the time that these stories are being recorded, or if that sort of like has always been there, you know, even if these stories are in fact, you know, thousands of years old or whatever, that somehow that idea of, you know, people in different social statuses belong to, you know, they're meant to stay in their social classes. I don't know. It's kind of interesting.
Right. Although the dynamic I've noticed in these stories is that the princess doesn't want to do it, and it turns out to be fine. It turns out to be a good thing that the hero is this kind of scrappy lower class person. The haughty princess might not want to marry him, but in the end, we're supposed to be glad she does.
Right.
Because our sympathies are with him.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is what we're going to see in the next one, too, when we get there. So.
You wonder who keeps buying them dancing shoes. Also, how much do you have to dance in one night to burn through your shoes?
Yeah, to wear them out.
That's crazy.
It is. There's a lot of unanswered questions in this one. I just thought it was a really fun little like mystery story though, you know, and it's like, I don't know, the whole idea of like, there's this huge underground palace, really an underground kingdom, you know, underneath this other king's kingdom. So it's kind of a fun, fascinating idea.
The secret, yeah, absolutely.
The secret tunnel under the stairs, you know, or under the bed. I mean, the secret stairs under the bed. All right. Well, it's very frowned upon behavior to dance all night in an underground palace. That's what I wrote down.
Well, I mean, the real problem is they're not doing what the king's telling them to do, right? They're questioning his authority.
That's right. Go to bed, kids. When your parents tell you to go to bed, no staying up all night dancing.
Do you think your many daughters go out in the middle of the night and dance?
I'm gonna have to watch for it now.
Do you check their dancing shoes? Do they give you a glass of drugged wine before you go to bed?
Yeah, I don't usually check their dancing shoes, but I guess I ought to. Maybe they're getting worn out here. So I don't know that they have dancing shoes. But you're right. Who's buying them more new dancing shoes every day?
Maybe if they made them dance in their regular shoes, this wouldn't happen.
Or why not just remove the shoes from the room before they go to bed? So they don't have dancing shoes to dance in.
It would just go to a sock hop. All the cats would join in, you know what I mean?
Right. All right. Okay, our next one is The Six Servants. So much like Michael said, once upon a time, there was an old queen. She's a sorceress, and she's got a beautiful daughter that everyone wants to marry, but the old queen sorceress will always set these impossible tasks for the suitors and then kill them when they fail. No one is good enough for her daughter. So one prince, he heard about this beautiful maiden and he wants to go try this thing. And his father, who's king, says, no, you can't do that. You'll die. And so then he becomes so depressed because he wants to marry and rescue this beautiful maiden that he withdraws within himself and he is sick in bed for 7 years and he's near death. When finally his dad says, okay, you're going to die anyway in this bed. You might as well go and try to rescue this princess. So he miraculously heals then because his heart is lightened and he sets out on his journey to go and marry this princess. So along the way, he meets six men, his six servants. And the first one, he's coming along and it looks like there's a giant pile of hay in the field, but it's actually a man. He's just that fat. He's just this fat man. And so he hires him on as a servant. And then they come to a man who is laying on the ground with his ear to the ground. And they ask him what he's doing. And he says, I'm listening to the grass grow. I can even hear the grass grow. And so he says, well, that's great. So he takes him. And then they come upon some feet, followed by some legs, followed by a body. And it's so long. And they just keep walking past this thing. They finally get to the top of this man who's laying on the ground. And they said, we never thought we'd even get to the end of you. And this is the tall man. And they hire him. And then they come upon a man who is blindfolded. And he says that if he removes his blindfold, his glance can shatter things. And so they definitely take him. And then they come along a guy who, even though he's out in the hot sun, he's freezing. And he says that he's opposite. So if it's really hot, he's freezing. And if it's really cold, he's hot. And so they call him Frosty and they bring him along. And then they meet a second sharp eyes guy. The first one can blast things, but this guy can just see extremely far and know where things are. So they hire him as well. So those are the six servants. So they get to the evil sorceress, and the first task that she sets them is to bring back a ring I dropped in the Red Sea. So they go to the Red Sea, sharp eyes, the looking sharp eyes, can see it easily, and even in the water. So then Fat Man drinks up all the water in the Red Sea, and then Tall Man leans down into the valley or the gulf that's left after the lake is drained and picks up the ring. So then the second task is he has to eat 300 oxen, the skins and bones and hair and horns and everything, and also drink 300 barrels of wine. And he says, can I bring a guest? And she says, only one. So he brings Fat Man, of course, and Fat Man eats it all, and it's no problem for him to do that. And so then finally she's like, wow, no one's got this far before. But for this last task, you have to keep the princess in your arms until midnight. So this seems like an easy task. In the evening, he takes the princess into his arms. The moonlight is there. He's looking at her. He's just so content to gaze at her beauty. But then at 11 o'clock, the evil sorceress casts a magic spell and they all fall asleep. And then she whisks the princess away. And at 11:45, the spell wears off. They all wake up and they're all panicked. What can we do? And a listener listens to find out where the princess is. She's in a rock 300 miles away. And so Tall Man takes three big steps to get there. Sharp Eyes removes his blindfold and blasts the rock open to get the girl, bring him back. And she gets back into the prince's lap just in time. The evil sorceress comes in and she is defeated and she must let her princess marry this prince. But then she has one final blow before she goes, and she whispers into her daughter's ear that it is a disgrace to marry this man, and it brings up this vileness within the daughter. And so the daughter says, you've passed my mother's task, but now you have to pass my task. You must step into the fire for 3 days. And she thinks that he'll have to do it himself because no servant would ever do that for him. But, of course, Frosty hasn't done anything yet. He's just been hanging out. So they throw Frosty in the fire. He burns for 3 days. He comes out and he says, I almost couldn't stand it. I'm freezing cold. And so they get to get married. But then seems this is the second false ending, but here we go. So then the sorceress mother, she can't stand that her daughter is getting married, so she sends soldiers after them. So Fat Man spits onto the road, he makes a lake, and then Sharp Eyes blasts them with his blasty eyes, and they escape from the evil sorcerer's army. Then they arrive in the kingdom, but he says, oh, surprise, I'm not actually a prince, I'm a swineherd. And so she has to live as a swineherder for a week, and during that time she learns humility, and then surprise, he's not a swineherd, he's a prince, and they get happily married. And you can bet the one who told this tale wishes that he had been there too.
Wow.
Yeah. Quite a shocking story. Multiple false endings on that one.
We've seen another one like this, right? Obviously, I don't remember the title because there's so many we've read. But there's another one with five or six people who have weird special powers like this.
That's right. And I don't think we talked about it at the time.
I don't think we did either.
Yeah, because I looked back to see it. But yes, yeah, there was an early one that we had these special powers one.
You know, House Six made their way in the world. That's the name of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And like they're superheroes basically, right?
Yeah, it's like X-Men. Like Cyclops, and you know, shooting the lasers out of his eyes, and Tall Man's kind of like he's not an X-Man, but kind of like Mr. Fantastic or something like that, you know.
Did you ever read Five Chinese Brothers?
No, I'm not familiar with that one.
That was a children's book, which I guess is based on a Chinese folktale that I remember having read to me when I was in elementary school. And famously, there's an R.E.M. song called Seven Chinese Brothers. And the only lyric I've ever been able to pick out in the song is Seven Chinese Brothers Swallowing the Ocean, because one of the five Chinese brothers was able to swallow the ocean. That was his superpower, and Lord knows I don't remember how it benefited him and his brothers.
Yeah.
But it seems like this is a story type that crosses those national lines. Because it is a Chinese folktale in addition to being a European one.
Yeah, and I think those types of things are the arguments for, like, these stories are really, really, really old.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because there must have been either a common story before the peoples all separated, or at least it's old enough that it was able to travel, you know, across, you know, all these places, even when travel wasn't as common as it is now, you know.
Right.
Or whatever. So, you know, I'm kind of glancing through a book as we read these, called Cinderella's Golden Slipper, that tries to talk about the symbolism of these things. And he's in that book, he argues that these type of stories are like the characters represent like different parts of our humanity. Like it's like our kind of like the five senses, like tasting, seeing, smelling, hearing, you know. There's not really a smelling one in this one. I think there is in the other one, the how six travelers made their way across the world, whatever. And there's some sort of like message in here, not message, but like we were talking about before, like the deeper reality of some sort of thing of like, you have to learn to master all of yourself in order to obtain happiness or something, you know, fulfillment. I don't know if I quite see it, though.
Yeah, well, and it's interesting, right, that he doesn't have to do it himself, that these are servants. And it's what really struck me reading it is the way that they seem to be just willing to be his servants. You would think that some of these guys could do whatever they wanted. They could be in charge of their own lives. They don't need to serve anybody.
Right.
And this guy, who doesn't have anything super remarkable about him, somehow gets to be their leader.
Right.
There's, you know, the Democrat in me is offended by this in some ways, you know.
Yeah. But I think that's the argument for like this is more symbolic, you know, because it's like your will or your, you know, whatever you want to say, like your mind, your, you know, something has to take control of all these other aspects. So it's not like they're separate. I mean, in the story, obviously they're separate from him, but symbolically they're all part of him, and he has to master all of them, or he has to use them wisely or something. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not sure that I'm fully bought in on it, but I think that's the argument. I just thought it was really fun because it was like when I first read it, I was like, oh, this is like proto X-Men. This is really cool.
Yeah, it really is. And you get some superpowers that you don't see so much in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
That's right.
Being really fat.
Being really fat. It's a great
or being cold when it's hot outside.
Yeah. It seems like that one would backfire if you're inside a fire, like, because you can get cold enough to die also. So, you know, it seems like just being in a really hot place would just make you extremely cold and you'd still be susceptible. But I guess not. It's a fairy tale. It's a fairy tale. Don't overthink it.
Don't overthink it.
Yeah, the fat man reminded me of Strange Brew. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
The Rick Moranis movie.
I don't know what I expected you to say there, Josh, but Strange Brew is not it.
Oh, man. I love that movie. I was rereading the plot of it on Wikipedia because I was like, I know there's something like this in here. And there was like so much of the movie that I've completely forgotten. So I shouldn't say I love that movie because I was like, is this even the same movie? But anyway, there's a moment in the movie when he's locked in a vat and he's going to be drowned. They're going to pour the beer in and drown him, but instead he drinks all the beer, so he's safe. But he like turns cartoonishly fat, of course, because he drank an entire vat of beer.
See, but that's the one of the Chinese brothers swallowing the ocean.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder if that movie is based on. It's so strange. It makes you want to be a folklorist.
It does. It does make you want to be a folklorist. So yeah, it's kind of funny. I also thought the Red Sea was a really interesting thing, that the Red Sea gets thrown in there. You know, because wherever this is being told, European, presumably, you know, the Red Sea is pretty far away. But
yeah, almost nobody who would have heard it originally would have ever seen the Red Sea.
Yeah. So my thought on that one, this is just me just totally out of my head. Like, I was like, maybe it's this idea, like, you know, all, I feel like sorcery, like, originates in Egypt, right? So maybe it's like something like the Egyptian, like she wants this ring because it's, you know, connected somehow to the Egyptians, you know, getting drowned in the Red Sea or something. I don't know. That's all I got. Probably a stretch.
All right. Well, our next one is the White Bride and the Black Bride. So the Lord comes down to Earth and asks this woman and her daughter if they know how to get to the village. And for some reason, they refuse to help him. But the woman's stepdaughter offers to show him. And the Lord is so angry that he turns the mother and the natural daughter black and ugly and gives the stepdaughter three wishes. So she wishes for beauty. She wishes for gold that will never run out. And then at his prompting, she wishes to go to the kingdom of heaven after she dies. I want to live in the eternal kingdom of heaven after my death. But he has to prompt her to that one, which is very nice of him. It's how you know the Lord is not a genie, because a genie would just let her forget that part. Well, she's so beautiful that her brother, who is the king's coachman, comes to her and asks for a portrait of her and wants to hang it in her room, in his room. And when the king sees this portrait, he decides he wants to marry the white daughter, or I guess the stepdaughter. So she comes, and the stepmother and the stepsister also come. And the stepmother uses her magical powers to make the coachman half blind and make the stepdaughter half deaf. And so the stepdaughter doesn't hear what her brother says and instead does what her stepmother says, which is to take off her dress and her clothes and then to go over to the window, and she pushes her out the window. And so the goal here is that the stepmother is going to try to trick the king into thinking that her natural daughter, who has been turned black and ugly, is, you know, the one he wants to marry. This doesn't work. The king is horrified by this woman, and he throws the brother into a snake pit for trying to trick him. But nevertheless, the stepmother manages to convince him that he is going to marry the black bride. So one day, a white duck comes into the castle's kitchen and asks what's going on with the bride and with the coachman. And finally, the kitchen boy goes and tells the king about this duck, and the king cuts the duck's head off, and then the duck turns into the white bride. The king takes the brother out of the snake pit and you know, realizes everything that's going on. And so he goes to the stepmother, says, tells her what's happened, says, what would you do to punish someone who had done this? And she says, well, they should be stripped naked and put into a barrel with a bunch of nails pointing inward and then dragged off by a horse. So that's exactly what the king does to her and the black bride. And he marries the white bride and they live happily ever after. No forgiveness in this one.
No. And like I had my mic muted, but I was giggling through your whole retelling of that one. You told it very, there's something about the matter of factness in which you stated all of that.
All of this absurd stuff.
That made it really, really funny to me. So well done.
Thank you.
Yeah. I like the, like you said about the Lord coming and appearing before them. And I mean, there is a little bit of that, like, you know, biblically, there's this idea of like, you know, whatever you did to the least of these, you did unto me. And so like, you know, or you may be entertaining angels without knowing it, you know? So like, there is that sort of idea that, you know, who knows, you know, like when you're treating someone kindly, that the Lord isn't taking it as, you know, this is what you're doing unto me as well. So that part jived, but then once he becomes a genie, like you said, it's kind of like, oh, this is a very different Lord than the one that like Solomon talks to, you know, like Solomon gets the riches and the wealth because he doesn't ask for it. He asks for wisdom, and she, you know, asks for all the good stuff. And then she's like, and then he's like, but don't forget the best thing.
Yeah, it is really weird that he gives her that reminder.
Yeah.
But so. She is, you know, she does the bare minimum to help him. I feel like giving somebody directions to a nearby village is not heroic.
No.
But I guess he's just so mad at the stepmother and stepsister that that this seems really nice.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. That's funny.
What do you make of the racial aspect of this story?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it's...
she's being turned African or whether she's being... Like, her skin is actually becoming black, right?
Yeah, yeah. It wasn't clear, you know. I'm sure it's been read both ways. Yeah, I don't know. It's a weird thing. It's... I mean, the idea of the lighter being more beautiful... It's like you were talking about with that Twilight Zone episode, you know, like how much of that is societal and how much of that is, I almost want to say like demonic, you know, because it's everywhere. Like this idea, like, I mean, I've lived in other countries in America, you know, and so like living in China, like there's a real aspect of, your darker skin it's not beautiful. It's low class, you know, I mean, because I mean, and then some of that too, like, is it society or is it something else? Like, you know, traditionally the people who had to work outdoors, obviously were going to be darker skinned, you know, being in the sun all the time. And so there is like a lower status work, I guess, to that. But I don't know. It's just very, I'm bumbling around because anytime we get onto a race topic, I bumble around. But, you know, that's all I got.
I don't remember anything else in the story that had any kind of racial characteristics other than just the words black and ugly.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it may be that she's just supposed to be, you know, have skin the color of midnight, an unnatural color for human beings.
Right. Yeah. And but it's weird in the story. I forget exactly what it says, but like he ends up kind of being like, he's repulsed at first, but then he ends up being kind of strangely attracted to it. And so I don't know. I think that's also like a, I don't know. Isn't that kind of true too? Like like sometimes the things that we first come across and we find horrifying, then, you know, like we can't look away. And so then, I don't know. I thought that was kind of interesting. But it's through his, it's through her witchcraft. So I don't know. It's just kind of weird. But anyway.
I was going to say, if she's such a powerful witch, why does she not change her daughter back? But of course she can't, because the Lord did it.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And there is some weird stuff in here. I mean, with the one just before this too, like why let the spell wear off at 11:45? Like why not let them not wake up until midnight and then they wouldn't have time to fix it or whatever, you know, it's just, yeah, it's evil doing evil and not being able to, I guess that's, you know, part of the thing. Evil can never fully conquer. And we see again, the evil being so, foolish or blinded even to their own evil that they, you know, they curse themselves with their own answers to these questions and stuff. So it's very, it happens a lot in these stories. What do you think about the cutting off the head to restore the life? I feel like we've seen this once before, but I couldn't remember where.
Yeah, I know we've seen it before. It's like a death to rebirth thing, but I can't remember where exactly we saw it.
Yeah, it's always kind of funny to me. It's like you cut off the head and then it brings you life. You know what it was? It was the fox, the helpful fox. So that it's like cut off my head and my hands and my feet.
That's right. And she doesn't want to do it.
Yeah.
She waits for years.
Yeah. And then when he does it, like restores him to a prince or whatever. So, but yeah, you're right. It's, there's something about, I don't know. I'm sure there's something there about cutting off the old and brings forth the new, but it's just kind of weird. It's a weird thing. It's very, we read a story earlier, the three little gnomes in the forest. And in that one, it's a similar situation where the queen, the true queen or the true bride or whatever dies and is turned into a, I don't remember. She turns into a bird, a duck, I think. But in that one, then she can like, she goes up to nurse the baby, so like she can like transform out of the duck, and the king has to swing the sword over her head three times, so he doesn't actually chop off her head, but he swings the sword over her head three times and it turns her to back into, brings her back to life. So
it's like enacting the decapitation without actually performing it,
yeah, or something like that. So
well, next up we have the donkey, not to be confused with the lettuce donkey, which is a different donkey story. Did we talk about that last time?
Did we talk about that? I think we did. Yeah, but go ahead.
So there's a king and a queen, and they are not able to have children. And this is a source of deep sadness for the queen, who says, "I'm like a field on which nothing grows." One of the sadder lines in these fairy tales, in my opinion. Well, eventually, she does have a baby, but it's a donkey. And she's not super happy about it, as you might imagine. She wants to have it killed. But the king says, no, God gave us this donkey, so we're going to raise it, and the donkey's going to be my son and heir. And the donkey wants to learn how to play the lute, which would be very difficult for a donkey because he doesn't have fingers. But nevertheless, he works really hard and becomes a better lute player even than the person who taught him how to play it. One day he sees himself in the mirror, and it makes him sad because he realizes he's a donkey, and so he decides to leave the kingdom. And eventually he gets to another kingdom where the king is very old and the king's daughter is very beautiful, and initially they won't let him into the kingdom, but then he plays his lute and they let him in. They make fun of him at first, but the donkey insists on his dignity, and he insists on being treated as a member of the court. And so the king lets the donkey sit beside his daughter, and he, you know, he acts like he belongs in the court, which I suppose he does, as he is the son of a king. As time goes on in this new kingdom, the donkey gets sadder and sadder, and the king keeps trying to make him happy. And ultimately, the donkey says, the only way I'm going to be happy is if you let me marry your daughter. And so they do marry him. They do marry. And after the wedding, the king sends one of his men into the bedroom to make sure that the donkey is treating his daughter respectfully. And the guy sees the donkey take off his donkey skin and sees that underneath he is a, you know, handsome, regular person. And when the king finds out about this, he goes and watches himself, and then later he throws the donkey skin away, so that the man is going to have to reveal himself to be human to the daughter. But when the guy wakes up and finds his donkey skin missing, he panics and runs away. But the king sees him on his way out and says, "No, stay. I'm going to make you my heir." And the guy stays, and now he gets to be the heir to two different kingdoms, the king of the kingdom of his father and the kingdom of his father-in-law. And so everybody lives happily ever after.
Yeah, we saw something kind of like this with
Hans my Hedgehog,
right? He takes off the hedgehog. I mean, he's born a hedgehog, but then somehow he can take off the skin. And here he's born a donkey, and then somehow he can take it off once he's married.
Yeah, it's not clear whether he knows that he's able to take it off before he gets married, or if this is like a power that marriage brings out in him, or what. It's also got, we talked about on Hans and My Hedgehog about the kind of weird sexual undercurrent. The idea that the king would send somebody to watch to make sure the donkey is treating his daughter well. I mean, that's kind of exactly what you would do if your daughter married somebody you thought was a donkey, right? You would want to make sure that the donkey was treating her the way a human being should be treated and not the way a donkey would be treated.
Right.
You know, on your wedding night.
Yeah. Yeah.
I found that to be a really interesting detail.
That's a good way to put it. What an interesting detail. Yeah. I found it weird. I found the weird detail was that he's like horrified that, like, because the king throws his donkey skin in the fire and it says, he got up with the first rays of the sun and wanted to put on his donkey skin, but he could not find it anywhere. So he was horrified and overcome by sadness and dread. "Now I must find some way to flee," he said, you know, like,
well, everything this guy does, he's overcome by sadness and dread, which I got to say, like, I relate. He's sad to be a donkey. He's sad when he's not a donkey anymore. Yeah, that is the only part of the story that really makes sense to me.
I gotcha. All right. That clarifies it. Thank you.
I think Hans My Hedgehog actually has an explanation, right? That in Hans My Hedgehog, doesn't the queen say, I want a child even if it's a hedgehog?
Yeah, something like that.
And there you can see God kind of, you know, laughing at her a little bit, but what happens to this queen is just cruel, right? Like, this is a woman who says, as I said, one of the saddest things that I've seen in any of these, I'm like a field on which nothing will grow.
Yeah.
And what? She gives birth to a donkey?
Yeah.
The story also has stuff in common with the Tom Thumb stories. Thumbling, I think, is what they're called in our translation.
Yeah, that's right.
There's a couple of those where you have a barren couple and they give birth to a kind of wondrous freak of nature child.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of that. It's just...
I wonder, donkeys must be associated with sadness, right? Like, that's why this donkey's sad at everything.
Oh, yeah, Eeyore.
Yeah. But I mean, even before Eeyore must be playing on an older folk tradition.
Donkeys are
sad.
Yes, I understand that. That was the first thing that popped into my head. Oh, yeah, yeah. I hadn't thought about that before.
Yeah, well, that's the only reason I can figure why it keeps bringing up how sad the donkey is. If donkeys are just supposed to be sad in folklore.
Yeah, maybe so. They're just kind of beasts of burden, you know.
They have sad faces.
Yeah. Yeah.
I really like that he insists on his dignity. That, no, you're not going to treat me like a donkey. I'm a person.
Right. Yeah, there's a little bit of the, like, the princess and the frog in that one, you know, where, like, he makes her promise, like, I'm, you know, I'll get your golden ball for you if you let me, you know, sit at the table and eat from your very bowl, you know? And then, of course, she's disgusted because he's like a frog, so she's not going to do it. But, like, you know, I had the same kind of vibe here where it's like, no, I'm not. You know, because at first he's, you know, they don't want him in the court at all, and then they're going to let him in, but he has to eat with the knights, and then he's like, no, I'm royalty, you know, I'm going to sit up here with with the royals.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He knows what he is, and he's going to insist on it.
Yeah.
I like it. I found this much less disturbing than Hans my Hedgehog.
But he doesn't ride on a rooster. He doesn't say, "Shoo my rooster, father."
Shoo my rooster.
I do like the little detail about the lute. It's like they don't just say, and then he learned how to play the lute. They highlight it for you that that's going to be really difficult. You don't.
Yeah, they say what you're thinking, which is, how are you going to play the lute with hooks?
Yeah, it works. All right, our next one is the turnip. I really love this story. I think it's so funny. So there's two brothers. One is rich and the other is poor. And so the poor one, he is gardening and he happens to grow this gigantic turnip. It's not really clear how it grows so gigantic, but it just grows bigger and bigger. And it's so large that you have to load it on a wagon and two oxen to pull it. And so he doesn't know what he's going to do with this, because what do you do with a turnip that's this gigantic? So he decides he's going to give it as a gift to the king. So he brings it to the king, and the king is amazed. He says, "Oh, I've seen so many amazing things, but I've never seen a turnip like this, you know?" And the king asks him who he is. He says, "Oh, you probably know my brother because he's rich, but I'm poor, and so you don't know who I am," or whatever. And the king's like, "Well, I will reward you for giving me this gigantic turnip." And he makes him even richer than his brother, which makes his brother jealous. But his brother has the idea, like, well, if my brother got all these riches just from giving a turnip, then I will give all these riches to the king and he'll reward me with something even better. So he brings all the gifts, the best gifts that he can imagine, to the king. And the king says, "This is amazing. The best thing I can think to give you is this giant turnip." And so the brother rewards him with the giant turnip. And so now the brother's really mad. And so he tells the younger brother, or the formerly poor brother, I guess. He tells the formerly poor brother, "Hey, I know where some secret buried treasure is. Let's go dig it up." And so they go out together. The turnip growing brother is suspecting nothing, but the other brother has murder in his heart, and some bandits attack them, and they're going to murder the turnip growing brother. But just as they are about to kill him, or to do the deed, they hear horns in the distance, and they're afraid that they're going to be caught. And so they stick him in a sack, and they run the sack up a tree, and they, you know, get away. And so then this turnip growing brother wiggles his way, so his head is sticking out of the sack, and a scholar happens to come walking by, and he hollers to the scholar, and he basically tells him, this sack is amazing. I've learned everything by hanging upside down in the sack. I know all the signs of the zodiac and the elements and all this stuff. And he's like, you have to try this. And the scholar is like, yeah, let me into the sack. And the brother's like, I don't know, you know, like I still got some more stuff to learn up here. And he's like, you know, give me a little more time. But the scholar can't stand it. He waits impatiently, and then he says, please let me in the sack. And he says, okay, let me down. And he sticks the scholar in the sack and then raises him up there and laughs and steals the scholar's horse and goes. But then about an hour later, he feels bad and he comes back and lets him down. The end.
It's a very nice ending.
when the king gives the older brother, or the rich brother, I don't know if it actually says in here if he's older or younger, when he gives the rich brother the turnip, I just, you know, in Bolt, the pigeons, and there's that one moment where it like flashes over the pigeons and the pigeon says, "Oh, the irony." That's just that's what pops into my head. It's very funny. But what else would you do with a giant turnip than give it as a reward for things?
Do you know that's what jack-o'-lanterns originally were?
Turnips.
Really? That's what I heard anyway. You know, it's just after Halloween when we're recording this, listeners, on election night.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, so I was watching something on YouTube about how jack-o'-lanterns were originally turnips. Turnips are gross, in my opinion. I wouldn't be so happy if I were the king.
It's a large turnip. It's a wonder, though. It's just amazing. You see those giant vegetables and stuff sometimes, you know, on the news or whatever. You know, they bring to these fairs, and they are that large. You know, where you need a tractor to haul them. It's kind of amazing. God's plant kingdom is amazing. I really am impressed by plants.
A turnip fit for a king.
Yeah, there you go. It's a real Cain and Abel kind of vibe in this story.
Yeah, but played for laughs, right?
But played totally for laughs. And then there's the weird, you know, kind of tag on the scholar also at the end.
Yeah, the joke on him. That's funny. And I do like that. Like, we have to see that this, because there's no reason why the scholar would have to go up in the bag. He could just ask the scholar to let him down. And instead he plays this very mean trick on this person he doesn't even know. And he feels bad about it. It shows you his heart is not altogether bad, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I just thought that was a really funny story. I don't know if there's anything else to say about it.
Yeah, I don't know that I have a lot either, other than the humor.
Yeah.
All right. We got a lot of others to do, so.
Yep, let's roll on. We got the stolen pennies. So there's a couple, and they have a good friend who comes over and joins them for dinner, and the clock strikes 12, and a little boy enters the room and goes through the room they're in and into the bedroom and then leaves. And the guest says, "Who's that little boy that just came in?" And the husband and wife are baffled. They didn't see this boy, and they don't know who this child is. And the same thing happens two more days in a row. They're eating dinner, and at 12 o'clock, clock strikes, and this boy comes in. So on the third day, the guest follows the boy, and he peeks through the door to see what he's doing, and he sees him rummaging in the cracks of the floorboards. But the boy looks up and sees the guest looking at him, and as soon as he does that, the boy disappears. And so now that he's got a good look at him, the man describes this child to the host family, and the mother realizes, "That's my child who died 4 weeks ago." And so they rip up the floorboards, and they find that there's two pennies there, and they realize that these are two pennies that the mother gave to that child in order to give to the poor, but the child must have stolen them and kept them for himself and hidden them away under the boards for some future, you know, mischief or, you know, just treat for himself or something. And so they give those two pennies away to the poor, and that now the ghostly child is never seen again. It allows his soul to rest in peace, I guess.
Another good Halloween story.
A really good Halloween story.
This is an urban legend, right? Like you've heard versions of this as an urban legend, where like a traveler is coming and he stops to pick up a hitchhiker, and it's a young girl in a prom dress.
Oh yeah.
And somehow he ends up at an old couple's house, and they're like, "Oh yeah, our daughter who died on prom night 25 years ago tonight." Blah blah blah.
Right.
Like that's a version of this story that you hear. Except here you see why the ghost has been left behind. That he has unfinished business, his soul can't move on in purgatory until retribution has been made for the crime he committed.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't say purgatory, but that's what I assume is going on.
Oh, yeah, something like that, for sure. And I mean, with the whole idea there that you can help bring some sort of reconciliation or rest or peace or whatever for a loved one who has died.
An All Souls Day story and not a Halloween story.
Sure.
But it's all part of the same festival.
Yeah. But those type of ghost stories, like, there's a million of them, and who doesn't love a good ghost story, you know? I'm a big Ghostbusters fan, as you may know or recall. And the IDW comic line ran a Ghostbusters. Eric Burnham was the writer, and he wrote many of these in the late 2010s. And so they retold a lot of these like kind of ghost stories, like it was kind of the spin on Ghostbusters, where, you know, I mean, they did the same ghost busting that they normally did, but there was also a little bit of, you know, this reconciliation or, you know, figuring out like why these souls are unsettled and stuff. So it was kind of fun to see that. And then obviously that also gets carried over, I think, probably a direct influence from the comic book line into that the latest Ghostbusters movie. I don't know if you saw it, Frozen Empire.
I did not.
They play it's not the best of the Ghostbusters movies, but they play with this idea too, that like there's objects that like our souls get attached to because there's some unfinished business, I think is the word that you just used. And I think that's the same words they use in the movie. Like there's some sort of unfinished business that the ghost, you know, hasn't dealt with. And so.
That makes sense to me. I mean, I'm Catholic, so I believe in purgatory. So it does make sense to me that some sort of retribution would have to be made before you could move on to your final destination. I like the idea that those of us left on Earth might occasionally have a responsibility to play with that. Certainly Catholics believe we should be praying for our dead loved ones, which is not exactly the same thing as physically returning pennies, but you know, it exists on a spectrum with it anyway.
So yeah, for sure.
I see this as it's a kind of semi-creepy, semi-pious little story.
Yeah. Yeah, and even as a Protestant, I can get on board with the idea that, you know, like the things that we do in this life, they have eternal consequences, right? And so the idea that just because someone has died, that their actions don't have ongoing continuing consequences in both this world and the next one, you know, like it makes that makes sense, you know, like, and so, yeah. And that we're all part of the same continuing story so that there's things that we can do to, you know, bring justice or retribution or whatever. It's good. So that all makes sense to me too. They're fun.
Great. We don't have to fight about it. That's good.
Oh, did you want to fight? I can.
I think you and I, in the 20 years we've known each other, have had one fight, maybe.
And I still haven't let it go.
You should bring it up every night.
Yeah, I actually don't know if that's even true because I don't recall what that fight would have been.
You and I got in a fight. This is such a like a early 21st century Christian college fight. You and I had a fight about whether Johnny Cash's Hurt should be played on our Christian college radio station.
Okay. Yeah.
I said yes, and you said no.
Yeah, I think you were right on that one though.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
I was probably a jerk about it. I'm a jerk about most things.
Yeah, I think I, anyway, we don't need to rehash old college.
What if we really got into it right now? Really thought about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to Snow White and Rose Red, which has nothing to do other than the title with the heroine of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. That's a totally different Snow White. Here, Snow White and Rose Red are sisters. Their mother is a poor widow, and she named them after the rose bushes that sit outside her cottage. Some of them are Snow White, and some of them are Rose Red, and so that's where these two girls get their names. They're both very good girls. They love each other very much. They love their mother very much, but they have kind of opposite personalities. Snow White is very introverted. She likes to stay indoors. Rose Red is very extroverted. She likes to go outside and talk to people. She's very cheerful. Snow White is a little bit more melancholy. Well, one night in the middle of the winter, someone knocks at the door, and Rose Red opens the door, and there's a bear, and she starts to freak out, but the bear's like, "Don't be afraid. All I want to do is warm up inside the fire." And so they let him in, and he lies down in front of the fire, and they play around with him. And I think if I'm not misremembering, there's also a series of smaller animals in the cottage, and they also get along with the bear. But anyway, the next morning he goes back out into the woods, but he comes back every night for the rest of the winter, and everybody becomes very close friends with him. When the winter's over, the bear comes to them and says, "I have to leave for a little while because, as you know, at the end of the winter, the dwarves can come out of the ground. They can't come out in the winter because the ground is frozen. But now that it's summer, the dwarves are going to come out of the ground and they're going to steal my treasure." So he leaves, and later that summer, the girls are walking through the forest, and they run across a dwarf, and his beard is stuck in a tree. So they cut him loose because they're nice people, but the dwarf yells at them because he loved his beard, and they've defaced it. And actually, this is the first of several times that they run into him that summer. And each time he's in some predicament, and each time they free him from that predicament, and each time he gets mad at them for doing so. You would think, this is how you know they're better people than I am. I would just stop rescuing him. I would just let him, you know, die from being stuck in the tree or whatever. But anyway, they meet him one more time, and this time he's afraid because the bear is about to kill him, and he's begging the bear not to eat him, but instead to eat Snow White and Rose Red. But of course, the bear doesn't listen to this because Snow White and Rose Red are his friends. And so he kills the dwarf. And as soon as he kills the dwarf, the bear turns into a prince, because the dwarf had actually put a spell on the prince, turning him into a bear. And the death of the dwarf broke that curse. So Snow White marries the prince. Rose Red marries his brother. And their mother gets to move in with them, and she even brings the two rose bushes and plants them outside the castle. And everyone lived happily ever after.
Yeah. That dwarf is the worst.
He's a lot different than the dwarfs in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, isn't he?
Yeah. he's terrible. The second time that they cut, so he gets his beard caught in a fishing line. And the fish is too big for him to pull in, so the fish is going to pull him into the water. And so they cut the line, but also cut part of his beard. And he yells at them, you've disfigured my face like barbarians. It was not enough that you clipped the tip of my beard. Now you've cut off the best part. I won't be able to show myself among my friends.
The best part.
May you both walk for miles on end until the soles of your shoes are burned off.
Yeah. Jeez.
Nice guy. You have a beard, Michael. Maybe you can relate better than
mine's not that long. Like, I don't know that you could really cut off part of my beard, but I've been listening to ZZ Top lately, and boy, I bet they'd be mad. I bet they would prefer just to drown by having their beard caught in a fishing line than to have you cut it.
Yeah,
now I'm picturing that dwarf as Billy Gibbons or somebody.
There you go. Yeah. So here, I think we see more of the same that we've been talking about. Like, the dwarf is so into his villainy that he doesn't even recognize the bear that he cursed himself. You know, it's always the same with these villains. Like, they're always, you know, they're not quite up to snuff, and they, you know, their evil is their own undoing. You know, and we also see another disguised lover, the bear in disguise, being able to take his skin off. And so it reminded me a little bit of Bearskin, when we read Bearskin, where the guy is not allowed to wash, you know, and so he becomes this kind of bear type creature. And it's, you know, in that case, it was the devil who curses him to do that. Or it's a bargain, I guess, with the devil in that one. But it's a little bit like that. Like, this dwarf has cursed him to become a bear.
There's not a kind of standard reading of dwarfs in these stories.
Yeah.
So, sometimes they're good. Sometimes they're bad. Sometimes they're just kind of mischievous. It's interesting. There's not like one version of dwarfdom.
Right.
In Grimm's.
Yeah. They're kind of, they're definitely not monolithic type creatures, you know.
You never know what you're going to get when you run across a dwarf.
That's right.
So maybe they were right to continue to try to rescue him.
Yeah. Maybe they just didn't know, you know. You definitely don't want to be unkind to a dwarf. I feel like the fairy tales where you're unkind to a dwarf, it does not go well for you. So better to
basically
be
being
to
unkind.
It.
I mean, maybe if there is a consistent moral lesson, be kind to people.
Yeah, that's right.
You never know when it's going to be the Lord asking you for directions to the most recent or the closest village. Do you think, to return to that story, do you think God honestly forgot where it was, or was it a test? Like, he came down and he was so focused on his shopping list that he didn't remember where the village was. I kind of like the idea that God would be kind of charmingly absent-minded.
Yeah.
But God's not in this one. It's just the dwarf and the bear.
That's right. I like that idea. Yeah, maybe there's something about. Well, anyway, I don't want to go too far down this trail. I don't want to cross over into blasphemy or heresy or anything like that. But
yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, there are stories of like time travel, for example, where like the process of the time travel itself is kind of discombobulating in some way, and so it's like hard to like know exactly where get your bearings, right? So maybe entering time for God, being outside of time and then entering it, maybe it's just a little discombobulating at first. So anyway,
but to return to Snow White and Rose Red.
It's a very cute little story. You're right. If you were expecting Snow White, it's nothing like Snow White at all.
Except there is a dwarf.
There is a dwarf, but there's no evil stepmother. There's no, you know, there's no apples. No magic mirrors. None of those things.
I feel like this is like a second or third tier Grimm's, though. I feel like Snow White and Rose Red is a story people know. Some people. They've never made a Disney property out of it, but I feel like it is something that people are, at least some people are familiar with.
Yeah. Did you know this?
I had heard it, but I don't know that I could have told you the plot of the story.
Yeah. I think I knew somewhere in the back of my mind that there was a corollary, if you would call it that, to Snow White that was Rose Red or Red Rose, I mean. But I couldn't have told you more than that. So I think it's always funny when there's like two sisters and then there's the prince and there's only one prince. But then miraculously, there's a brother. Like he wasn't mentioned at all until the last line of the story. But here he is.
Well, so, to be fair, they didn't know that the bear was a prince until the last line of the story either.
That's also true. But it's not like there was two bears running around or, you know. A bear and a fox or, you know, something. So. There was another one like that where it's like, and then his brother showed up and it's like, oh, okay, that's great. But yeah, everybody gets a happy ending.
Well, we got one more, Josh.
One more. Here we go. So once upon a time, there was this tailor and he gets lost in the woods, as often happens, and he sees a light and he thinks, oh, that maybe somebody over there can help me. And he goes over and there's a mean man in a cottage. But he begs, you know, he grabs onto the guy and says, please, I'm just this lost tailor. I don't want to be left out in the woods. And so he's not as cruel as he seems. He lets him come in and rest for the night. And then early in the morning, I guess, or, you know, he's still sleeping. He's awoken by this noise. He jumps out of bed to see what the noise is, and he comes out, and there is in the front yard, there is a large black bull, and there is a beautiful stag, and the bull and the stag are in this fight to the death. And the stag wins. He stabs the bull with his horns, and the bull falls over, and the tailor is just in shock at what he has seen. And the stag runs over and scoops the tailor into his horns and whisks him away, and they run all the way across the world until they reach this magic cave that the stag knocks on the door, and it's, you know, big open sesame, and the fire blazes out of the cave, and it's a real like Cave of Wonders type thing, and the tailor is once again terrified, but he hears this voice that says, enter without fear. And so he enters into the cave. And he sees a glass case, and in this glass case, it's like a little, like a model village. There's like a little tiny castle and the surrounding farms and stuff, and it's just all amazing and wonderfully rendered. And then he turns, and there's another glass case, and in this one, there's a beautiful maiden. He goes over to look at her, and she wakes up when he comes over, and she says, oh, this is great. My time of rescue is near. Get me out of this case. And so he lets her out. And she says, let me tell you my story. And she recounts the story of how she was the daughter of a rich count. And she and her older brother, they loved each other just so deeply that they decided they would never marry, but they would just stay together as brother and sister forever. And one day there was a mysterious stranger that came and visited them. And they both liked him and they invited him to stay longer. But he turns out to be a creepy sorcerer, and he puts a spell on the castle, making everybody fall fall asleep and makes her like she wakes up, but like she can't move or anything. And he comes in and he proposes to her and he stands there waiting for her to say yes. But she refuses him. And so then he leaves her room and she's unable to move or anything until the morning. And then the morning she gets up and she goes to find her brother to tell him what has happened and finds out that her brother left early to go hunting with this stranger. And so she's worried, of course. This is an uh-oh moment. So she goes out walking in the forest to find her brother and this man. And just as she gets there, he comes walking out of the forest and he has a stag with him on a rope. And she says, "What'd you do with my brother? And where'd you get this stag?" And he's not answering her. And she actually pulls out a pistol and shoots him right there. It's shocking part of the story. She just shoots him and it's point blank, but the bullet just bounces right off of him and he traps her and puts her into this glass case, and he shrinks the castle and all the surrounding things and puts it into the glass case, and all the servants and the people and, you know, and anybody who lived in this village, he puts them and he turns them into like a mist and puts them into these glass jars. And so she tells this whole story to the tailor, and the tailor is amazed, but she says, now we can free everyone. And so they get the castle and they put it on this lift, you know, to take it out of the cave, and it comes up and it becomes this beautiful thing. And they go back down and they get the glass jars and they free everyone. And she's, you know, it's all her people and she's so glad. And then the brother comes walking out of the forest. He's been restored. He was the stag. And by killing the tailor, who was the bull, then he broke the curse. And she promises she will marry the tailor, since the tailor was there to witness all this and rescue her. And so they all live happily ever after.
I feel like this fairy tale is the ultimate fairy tale, and that it contains pieces of literally every other fairy tale that anybody's ever talked about. You got the animal transformations, you've got brother and sister devotion, you've got forests, you've got tailors, you've got glass coffins, of course, just like in Snow White. It's got everything, something for everyone.
That's right. It all culminates in this. Although we have more to go.
Way more, actually.
Yes, way more. But you're right. And I think I keep picking those ones because I think those ones that just contain all the different elements, like they're just so fun to me. I just enjoy them so much. So, it's got a tailor. I think it's just fun, this idea of, like, I don't know, just being caught up in this whole, you know, like he's not even doing anything, you know, like he just gets lost in the woods. I think that's the stories where the character just, you know, starts off on a walk and gets lost in the woods and then caught up into these adventures. I also am really attracted to those as well.
Yeah, because as opposed to people who go on quests.
Yeah, I mean, not that I don't like the quest stories, but it's just there's something.
You like the Forrest Gump story where the guy just kind of happens into it.
Yes, I like the Forrest Gump stories.
That makes sense.
Yeah. We get another disappearing character as well. The man in the cottage seems important at first, and then there's never another word about him. So. It's just gone. Unless he was the bull, maybe. Maybe he was the evil.
He was the magician?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. That's not clear in the story.
Very little, to be fair, is clear in the story.
Yeah. So. I don't know. I honestly don't have very much else to say about this one. I know we're kind of at the end here, and it'd be nice to end on a big bang, but I just like the story.
Yeah, I don't have much to say about it either, because there's so much in it that it really is like composed of the butt ends of previous fairy tales. I just read, though, that this is not a folktale. They adapted it from a section of a novel called my German pronunciation is not going to be great, but it's Das Urvonte Muttersongen by Sylvanus.
Oh, Okay.
So this is like a written story, unlike some of the other ones, which is weird because I would have bet on this being a folktale just because there's so much accretion.
Yeah, but you know, I think we've noticed this once before because there was another one that we read that I really liked and that had so much in it, and it was by the painter guy. Right?
Oh yeah.
And it was kind of like he took all these things. So I wonder if, I mean, you're right that these, you know, we've talked so many times about the Shaggy Dog story nature of so many of these, but like, I wonder if you're set out to purposely write a fairy tale, that's when they really get all the elements, because it's like you're writing a fairy tale, so of course you want to put everything in it, you know. You want to put it all in your favorite parts. So that makes sense to me. I'm going to have to check out that novel now. I'm curious about that.
I've never heard of the author or the novel, but I don't know anything about German literature either.
Yeah. All right. You've given me homework.
Well, also, you know, you have to read another 100 pages of...
That's right. I'll do that first.
And with that in mind, I think we only have two more episodes in Grimm, right?
Yeah. So is that right? This was to 500.
Okay.
And the whole book is, to 700. So, I mean, before you get to the notes, is 729. So, yeah, I assume we'll do...
Yeah, we'll just do through 600 next time, and then through 720. We'll do an extra 30 pages for the one after that.
Yeah. So that'll
be great. So I've already read the next section to pick my readings, and we end the actual Grimm's fairy tales proper. And then we start to move into the religious tales for children, of which I'll pick one of those because they're not great. and then the omitted tales, selected tales from the annotation of 1856, Jakob Grimm's tales, published tales, selected tales from the annotations of 1856, selected tales from the posthumous papers of the Brothers Grimm. But we will, before the end of the next one, finish the actual published Grimm's fairy tales, the two volumes of those, which is something.
Yeah, check us out. We did something.
Do you want to go ahead and announce what we're going to talk about next? After, I mean, I guess we still have, it'll be at least 3 months before we get to it.
Yeah, let's keep it a secret for a minute.
All right, we'll do that.
We'll announce on the next one.
We did make that decision before we started recording. Yeah, what we didn't make a decision about is which stories we're going to talk about next time.
That's true. We have not made that decision yet. So we'll put out another little, you know, 2-minute episode sometime later this month, let people know.
Once we've made our decisions.
That's right.
Fortunately, the next thing we're going to talk about has way fewer stories. I need a break. I can't do another 750-page book.
Yeah, that's right. At some point, we're also going to have to talk about Wish, because we got to go back and finish the canon. You know
that might be what we need to do, is once we finish Grimm's, take a month and watch that, by all accounts, terrible movie, and then return to our next collection. Because I think we talked about it. We're not going to take a long break between Grimm's and the next reading, just because we've had so many months off for various things in the last 6 months.
Yeah, we've taken too many breaks.
We've abused our listeners' trust.
That's right. That's right. Just start calling us, I don't know, some other sporadic podcast. I won't throw anybody under the bus.
You all know who you are.
You all know who you are. All right. Well, this is pretty fun, Michael. And I hope it was fun for our listeners as well.
Yeah. And I'm really looking forward to some of these next time. There's a couple that I really can't wait to talk about. So our listeners will just have to wait a couple weeks to figure out what those are.
Yeah. And it's, as you can tell, it's because Michael did his homework and I did not. So
you know what, Josh? You, instead of reading ahead, reviewed these to a much greater extent than I did. So I feel like you carried us today.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say. I don't know.
Listeners might think that when we had an extra month to prepare, we would use that time to prepare, but as it turns out, not what we did. Not what I did anyway. I don't know what you did.
No, I did. Yeah. Anyway. Shh. That's too much peeking behind the curtain, Michael. All right. Well, our press liaison as far as we have one, is Kristen Filipic. And we are on the old interwebs at christianhumanist.org. And you can help us continue this conversation by reaching out to us at beforetheywerelive@gmail.com. And we also want to encourage you to set your podcast player's dials to the Christian Humanist Radio Network. And there you'll find an abundance of old shows. And there are some occasional new shows that will keep you going. Christian Feminist keeps plodding along, I think. So Michael and I know that there are a great number of podcasts out there that you could be spending your time on. So thank you for spending the time with us. Actually, I listened to a podcast earlier this month and he said, thank you for wasting this hour with us. So that was another hour of your life wasted. Anyway,
the classical ed guru, Joshua Gibbs, on his podcast, he goes, you could have been listening to a show about the history of country. He's clearly talking about like real podcasts he listens to. Right. Instead, you're listening to this. Thank you.
Yeah, we are sincerely grateful. It's nice that you spend the time with us. So thank you very much. So for Michael Farmer, I'm Joshua Altman-Schiffer. Let no one ever say that a poor tailor cannot advance far in the world and achieve great honors.
I'll never say that.